So tonight I want to talk about, well, I'm probably going to talk about a number of things, but I'm going to start by talking about awe. That's AWE, awe, as in shock and awe, not puppies awe. And first, a disclaimer. Marin Sangha is about Dharma and daily life. That's sort of the fundamental idea of Marin Sangha. It's on our website, and it's very important. The real criterion for our practice is not, am I having exalted experiences? The criterion is, am I causing less suffering? How can I cause less suffering? Can I cause less suffering to me and to others? And I want to point out that those are really the same thing, that there is this dichotomy that's quite useful most of the time. But when it comes to suffering, when you're causing suffering both to yourself and to others around you and to the world in general. So this is a great way to look at practice. So we can't be on retreats or in deep meditative states all the time. And this talk on the surface, mind you, is about peak experiences, not about daily life. Just a side note, Philip talked about awe many, many years ago, but I don't have a recording of that talk, unfortunately. I don't know what he said. There may be some overlap if you remember that. So, the word awe, Merriam-Webster's dictionary says, an emotion variously combining dread, veneration, and wonder that is inspired by authority or by the sacred or sublime. Okay. The Oxford English Dictionary, their definition of modern usage, I did not dig into archaic usages, but the modern usage is, quote, a feeling of reverential respect mixed with wonder or fear, typically as inspired by a person of great authority, accomplishments, etc., or by the power or beauty of the natural world. So I run into a problem already, and that is that awe is not quite the word I'm looking for here. So what is? Well, I'll explain the word with a story. In Wyoming in 2017, Barbara and I watched a total eclipse of the sun from right in front of the Grand Tetons in Wyoming. Great place to see an eclipse. So we met a young man who had driven up on a whim from Denver, and this is everything was booked up in advance, but he found some like $6 a night motel and stay. So he managed to get to the center line and see the eclipse. Just thought he would do that on a whim. And he was stunned. He was in shock afterwards. And one of our English companions said that he was gobsmacked. So gobsmacked is really a much better word than awe for describing this kind of reaction. But that makes for a really weird title for a Dharma talk. I mean, can you see that on the website? Gobsmackery, why you should pursue it or not. Anyway, so awe is the word that is going to be bandied about, but gobsmacked is really more accurate. So, speaking of total eclipses of the sun, as some of you know, Barbara and I are addicts. And we went to see a total solar eclipse in April this year. And it was 4 minutes of totality, a little over 4 minutes. By the way, I want to say if you think you have seen a total eclipse of the sun, you haven't. It's like thinking that you might have had an orgasm. It just doesn't work that way. If you've seen a total eclipse, you know it. Now, since this April eclipse, I've been following the Solar Eclipse Chasers Facebook group. And a lot of people saw this eclipse. It was their first eclipse. they saw an eclipse for the first time because it crossed large parts of the US as well as Mexico. And there were a lot of people putting comments in posts in this Facebook group about what a life-changing experience it was. And there were a number of reports on people experiencing post-eclipse letdown, as one person called it. So more on this in a little while. So one psychologist that wrote about the eclipse experience, this one in particular, I'm guessing that he saw it as well. What he said was that for 4 minutes, the people who were watching eclipse had no future, no past. They were entirely in the moment, completely involved in the experience of the eclipse. So what does that mean? I mean, what I take that to mean is that for 4 minutes, there was no second arrow. I know there certainly wasn't, this is my extrapolation, there certainly wasn't for me and the other people I talked to, no second arrow. Now, a lot of us use the term second arrow, and I just wanted to just review somewhat for anybody who is listening who doesn't know what second arrow is. And it's pretty simple. It's one of the, I think, more accessible concepts in Buddhism. If you're encountering your aunt, your Uncle Larry, and Uncle Larry asks, "What is this Buddhism thing? Why are you involved in Buddhism?" Can you don't want to start with dependent origination. You will put Uncle Larry into hyperspace immediately if you try to explain or even use the phrase dependent origination. But the second arrow is something that anybody can get. The idea that the first arrow is stuff that we can't avoid. We get sick. We lose our job. We stub our toe. Bad things happen. We can't avoid that. The second arrow is all the stuff that we add on. Like, oh, I'm going to need surgery on that knee next year. This is much worse than last time. Or conversely, oh, that was a great meal. Not quite as good as the dinner we had at Chez Panisse 2 years ago, but pretty good. Notice how the second arrow just diminishes our enjoyment and our presence for our actual experience and gets in the way and causes suffering. It's the biggest and most controllable aspect of suffering. It's the one that we can change. So the first arrow is inevitable, the second arrow is optional. So, and I find that this is a good practice for me. I'm lately been doing more and more sort of, oh, this is just second arrow. If I get annoyed with something, I'll just start saying, oh, yeah, this is mostly second arrow that I'm doing right now. And I find that very helpful. Just noticing, just acknowledging the second arrow can be a big step towards liberating from it. Or at least releasing some of the tenacious grip that it has. So the second arrow is temporal. It's about the future and the past. It's judging mind going, this is way worse than last time, or why do I keep screwing this up? Or I'm getting better at this, implying that you used to be bad. The second arrow is about the past and the future. It's about projections about the future. What can I do about this? Will I need surgery? I'm getting too old to do this. That comes up for me a lot these days. When you're really fully in the moment, there's no second arrow. Or at least that's my extrapolation from the teaching. And of course, we're never fully in the moment. There's always some kind of noise going on. Maybe the Buddha himself or the Arahants were fully in the moment and had no second arrow, but I've got plenty of second arrow business going on. So all these people for 4 minutes had no second arrow. And I think related to that, they had no hindrances. None of the five hindrances, no sloth and torpor, no agitation, no grasping. I mean, why would you grasp? It's all there. There's no aversion. It's just too beautiful. And what's to doubt? There's no doubt. So what's the importance here? So here's, this is the Buddha. Herein, monks, when sense desire is present, a monk knows there is sense desire in me. Or when sense desire is not present, he knows there is no sense desire in me. He knows how the arising of the non-arisen sense desire comes to be. He knows how the abandoning of the arisen sense desire comes to be. He knows how the non-arising and the future of the abandoned sense desire comes to be. And then he repeats that formula for each of the five hindrances. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's a pretty important teaching in our lineage in particular. So it's important to recognize a hindrance when it's present, but it's equally important to notice its absence. And when we're on retreat and various other places, we've all heard teachings about the hindrances and how to deal with hindrances when they arise and how to recognize them. But we don't often enough hear about the importance of noticing when the hindrances are absent. This is huge. And it can be such a wonderful experience. So I had an experience on a retreat some years ago. My practice is such that I can actually settle into fairly concentrated states of mind fairly easily on retreat. And then I get to a certain point and I really don't progress. So I was on a particular retreat. My concentration was very strong. It was access concentration or neighborhood concentration. And I really wanted to experience jhana, and it just wasn't happening. And it was frustrating. And then one morning, after sitting for a while and not getting anywhere, that this is all about expectations too, by the way, which Philip talks about a lot, I suddenly noticed that the hindrances were at bay. I'd been thinking, well, here I am in access concentration. Hindrances are, but wait a minute, the hindrances are really at bay. That is, the hindrances were pretty much not there. And once I acknowledged that, my greed for jhana and my annoyance at not achieving it, just sort of dropped away. And I realized that my goals had been getting in the way of me fully receiving the experiences it actually was, and fully receiving a really wonderful experience. For the rest of the day, I walked around with this huge grin on my face because I was enjoying the fact that the hindrances were pretty much not there. How often do we get that when the hindrances are not there? And how much had I simply not noticed because I was so wrapped up in a goal? So wrapped up in this low-level ongoing greed. So again, noticing when the hindrances are not there, it's a good thing. So back to the eclipse. So for many, the eclipse presented a transformative experience. They never would have, I think, articulated it as being an absence of the second arrow or an absence of the hindrances. But I think that's what the experience was for most of these people. But the problem with seeing the eclipse as a transformative experience is that experience depends on external circumstance. And that's why the post-eclipse letdown, the experience is over. People didn't particularly learn from the experience. The transformation that they experienced was temporary, just like everything else is temporary. There are other special experiences like absorption or painting or other arts. There are, we have a friend who is a very good painter. She enjoys the meditative absorption of painting. And she is in a beautiful state when she's painting. She really loves it, but she doesn't understand it as a discipline for understanding more about how the mind works or expanding our understanding of the mind's capacities. These are beautiful states, but say for the state of being a good enough painter that you're not bogged down in assessing and developing the technical part of the art, you have to become a good enough painter so that you're not bogged down in the technical aspects of it. Again, being a good musician can lead to absorption-like experiences when you're really involved in and lost in the music. But to be a good musician, you have to be willing to spend a long time being a bad musician. Even jhana states can have a letdown effect. I had a conversation a number of years ago with a Theravada nun, Western-born nun, who said that she had quit doing jhana practice because she didn't like the emotional experiences that she had after jhana. It was depressive. Now, Siddhartha Gautama, who we now know as the Buddha, studied with two teachers after leaving his home. And under one of the teachers, he mastered jhanas, including the state of neither perception nor non-perception. And then he later said, "The thought occurred to me, this Dhamma leads not to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, distilling, to direct knowledge, to awakening, nor to unbinding." Nibbana is literally unbinding. "But only to reappearance in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. So dissatisfied with that Dhamma, I left." So the Buddha, before he became enlightened, had achieved these highest of absorptive states, and they still weren't enough. This is Majjhima Nikaya, by the way, number 36. To paraphrase what he learned, "You've been in a sublimely ecstatic state, and then it's back to Dukkha land. You're just back in Dukkhaville." So how do we work with this skillfully? So ask yourself, after any high experience, and I think we often have them and don't notice them, but you ask yourself, what have you learned? What can you learn from this kind of experience? Well, I think we practice in part at least to get to know the mind. When you have this kind of experience, remember that you may no longer be having that experience, but you still do have the capacity for that experience. I think this is really important for dealing with difficult times, times when we feel like we can't experience joy and we'll never experience joy again. It's important to remind ourselves that we have experienced joy. We may not be experiencing joy right now, but we have the capacity for it. We know that because we've experienced it in the past. When the experience is strong, notice that you are temporarily without the hindrances, without the second arrow, that you've actually had a taste of nibbana. You know that the possibility of nibbana, however fleeting, is always there. I gave a whole talk not too long ago about joy and cultivating joy. And so I've talked about a lot of aspects of this. And I think that joy is something that we can cultivate, but part of it is just knowing that we have the capacity for it. We often use mindfulness techniques to deal with unpleasant states, but we rarely use mindfulness to fully receive pleasant states. So a problem, of course, is that we get into thinking of mindfulness as something like aspirin in the medicine chest, something that we only get out, something that we have in our toolkit for things that we don't like to fix ourselves. And that's unfortunate because mindfulness of pleasant states is very, very rewarding. We tend to want, usually when we have a pleasant state, instead of being mindful of it and just being with the experience, we want to maximize it, or we want to learn how to duplicate the state. Oh, this is great. I want to do this again. We rarely examine how joy manifests in the body, as if, for instance, we rarely consider how those manifestations might be cultivated. I also want to just talk about curiosity as an important tool for our spiritual growth and well-being. Because I think through curiosity, we can cultivate the capacity for surprise. And surprise and awe, or surprise and being gobsmacked, are closely linked. That guy in Wyoming who was gobsmacked at his first eclipse, in a way, he was fortunate that he didn't have expectations that could be met or not met. He wasn't spending a lot of time judging what he was seeing. He was able to lose himself entirely in the surprise. So he can sit down on the cushion or on a walk in the woods, and we can try to be gobsmacked at the miracle of existence and awareness. And another aspect of this that I haven't touched on is gratitude. We can know and we can cultivate gratitude just for the capacity of being gobsmacked and just for the capacity of joy. Even when the joy isn't there, we can experience gratitude for that capacity, for the capability of knowing that it's a possibility for us. So I said that it might be a short talk, and it is. So if people have comments or questions or rants or whatever, please. Nancy.
Bill, as you were talking, I was remembering one retreat during which I had the most ecstatic experience of my entire life. It lasted for a few hours. I don't know how to define it. I greedily chased it for years in retreats afterwards, never experienced it again. But during those 3 hours or so, I'd always been puzzled by the question of who are you? Who are you? And I would think, well, who am I? And review it in my mind. But during those 3 hours, I knew who I was, who we all are. It was a state of pure awareness. You talk about no hindrances. That was part of it. But I don't know how to define it or even if it matters if I do. Well, I guess maybe I do have a question about what it was. I mean, I had all the, we had it, I was in the dedicated practitioners program. We had an instruction to observe the origin of a word. No, the origin of a thought. And so I was in a very concentrated state and then slipped into this state. So I'm not, I don't know how to define it, but I knew things. I knew so many more things than I'd known before. And like all things, it was transitory. It came and it went. And I remember feeling it starting to subside. It was like, no, I didn't want it to. It was amazing. And I thought, if this is the state that monks live in, I understand why they forego everything. But anyway, I would love to have more of those experiences, but I didn't, and I'm not, I don't know exactly what to call it, but I've pondered it, and it was amazing. It was extraordinary.
Well, that's lovely, and thanks for sharing that. That's wonderful. And I could only speculate, but it sounds like you used the word pure awareness. You were very close to a very quiet, still aspect of mind. And that's wonderful. And of course, you noticed that you were chasing after it, you were greedy for it. And I've noticed this too. When I have a great experience, on a retreat, I'll try to duplicate that experience and it never works.
Oh,
There's a story about Ajahn Sumedho, and I've heard similar stories from other monks, long time practitioner monks. He apparently one time felt that he had become enlightened or was very close to it. He was in a state of absolute bliss. It was absolutely wonderful. I think he was there for something like 6 months and then it fell away. And he
wow.
was enormously frustrated and he was trying to get it back. He was trying to recreate it. And for a couple of years, he was trying to bring back and then realized that you just can't make that happen. You just have to keep moving forward. But I think I think your experience has had a good effect on you because you know that at least you may not be able to recreate it, but you have that capacity, and you have that memory. And when you talk about that memory, you kind of light up.
Yeah.
So it, the memory itself is a special thing for you. It's still a learning experience for you.
It still is. You know, I talked to Guy Armstrong, one of my most respected teachers, about this, and he said to me, "I've never had an experience like that." And I thought, "Wow." And then I realized it was extraordinary. I did realize things, but it's not about that. It's really about how you live your life.
Yes.
Yeah. So
Very
that's what I
much.
learned.
Thank you.
Thank
These
you.
experiences are great, and we can end up chasing them, but what it really comes down to is suffering, causing less suffering, padding.
Thank you, Bill. I really enjoyed that talk. And Nancy, you've inspired me to go back to concentration focus. I've been very much on meta focus, but I've been neglecting concentration. Meta does bring me to concentration, but not as, anyway, I don't have to get into that. I was going to say, I appreciate the concept of capacity, not only because it expands things I can be grateful for. I have a very strong and broad gratitude practice. I never thought about capacity. But it also helps me see people who don't agree with the way I see the world. I can find more peace with that because I know they have the capacity for growth. They have the capacity for a kind, loving heart. They have the capacity for a calm, clear mind. And the way I send metta to people who I find, whose policies I find anathema to me, is to send them every good blessing and to ask, may they have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. I'm always grateful to Philip for that phrasing because it's easy for me to wish them a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart, whereas sending love doesn't feel genuine. But sending wishes for their well-being does. And knowing they have the capacity for having a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart, the word capacity makes it even easier to recognize that in everybody, even in our so-called enemies. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad that that's helpful. By the way, I love metta practice, and I think metta can also take you to some very ecstatic states of mind. So I encourage. Well, I've talked about metta in the past. I had a lot of difficulty finding an approach to metta that resonated with me, And when I finally did, I found, the standard teachings I found, as they usually do them in retreats, did not work for me at all. And the metta practice that I have, I find very, very rewarding. And I think everybody finds a different approach to metta is effective. So what works for me may not work for you. So I would always encourage people, even if you think you have a strong metta practice, experiment with it.
A little over a year ago, when I broke my femur, I had to spend a month in a skilled nursing facility. And I turned it into my own personal metta retreat. And I've never been so calm and happy as when I couldn't change my own underwear and when I couldn't walk across the hall without help. It could have been humiliating, but I had so much metta for the people who helped me and the people who work there. That it transformed my entire experience. It just changed everything. So I know how powerful metta can be.
That's great. That's great. Thank you for that. So, Corey.
Patty, you always inspire me. Thank you. I love hearing your stories and how you really apply the Dharma in daily life. I really appreciate this topic, Bill. Awe to me reminds me the reason awe is so impactful for me, I think, is it reminds me. When something is awesome or I feel awe, it diminishes all importance of I, me, mine. Like I become, it reminds me how insignificant I am and how all my attachment to all my troubles and, fix it, problem solver, all this stuff that I get attached to, it's just, and so I think not only does the do the hindrances fall away and we are more present, but I think it's also that other piece, which is the diminishing of the self, the thinning of the self, and that's what awe really inspires in me and what I appreciate about awe. And what it reminds me of too, thinking about it in this way and in this conversation, is like when I do Qigong and I'm doing, how Philip would have us do here. And now, with different things here and now, is after a while that here and now become the same thing. And it takes thinking about them or applying them in these as if they're different. But through the practice, it all sort of dissolves. And kind of what you were saying, Nancy, about like just it, we're all this consciousness or whatever, that it just it all falls away. So anyway, that's when I think of awe, that's what I think of.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I think awe really takes one out of oneself. And I think when we talk about the hindrances falling away and the second arrow falling away, I think the self falls away too. I think all of them are tied together. And when we talk about one, we're simply t using a particular way of articulating that phenomena of not self and no hindrances and no second arrow. They're all the same thing. They're just different ways of articulating it. So thank you for that. Barbara.
Speaking of falling away, for some reason my reaction little prompt disappeared, so I had to use my hand. Wanted to say I really love these people's experiences. I feel that when we have these experiences that are so total, what is left when they are no longer with us is that felt sense of possibility. And it's almost like, in a sense, one can return to at least the possibility, ah, this is beyond, even though right now I'm in my life and I'm very much subject, object, whatever, that possibility remains and fleets. I think that can be army of faith. having that kind of faith, that kind of trust.
So, Barbara, can you repeat that last sentence? You were freezing up there.
Sorry. When it's very helpful with the parami of faith, to have faith, you have these experiences. They may be very short, they may be months long, but to have the faith that, oh, this reality was unveiled for me, or unveiled for whatever. But it is, I think, for me, that's a real source of being able to go on, a source of strength.
Thanks. That opens up a number of interesting topics. Anyone else? Cherie or Bauman?
Yeah, Bill, this is a great topic. I'm listening to what everybody has to say, and I can relate. About 4 years ago, or maybe 5 years ago, was the first time we were going out west. Where were we?
The Garapata Mountains in West Texas.
West Texas. And we're driving down the highway and, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, this massive mountain was just, like you say, in awe. And, when I think about that moment, it's like my perspective of everything changed. There was just this like click, like it. Interconnectedness, the ancestors of the past, and with the earth, and it was really transformative. And it like cracked my heart open, and I even just talking about it, I get teary-eyed. It was just such a spiritual experience. And yeah, as people are talking, that's what it was like. Everything else disappeared. It was just being present in that moment with this just spectacularness, And I sometimes think about that when things aren't going so well, and you use that word that, we have the capacity. And that's one of those moments that I can draw on and say, yeah, well, life can be a lot different than it is in this moment. Remember that. So, thanks for this topic. It's really important, and it does give hope when there's none or less. When there's less, it kind of brings it up a bit.
Good. I'm hearing that a lot of people found the idea of the capacity for certain states to be very helpful. And that's good. I do too, because there are times when I don't feel so good, and I have to remember that I have felt good in the past. I have the capacity for feeling good. And I have found that helpful too. So I'm glad that I was able to convey that. Anyone else? Well, I said we could end early. Oh, Rick.
Yes, I've had several or a bunch of those kind of experiences. Probably beginning with my high quality, high dose LSD experiences several times, and also several near death, surviving several near-death experiences, and also when my children were born, and stuff like that. Nothing that can be recreated and barely remembered. I mean, I remember it happened, but you don't have a total feeling. And you're in that experience, it's like a total, is swimming in a totally different world kind of thing. Can't remember I did that, but I don't have a feeling of it so much, a little bit. It helps to remember those times, I think. But what do I know?
No,
It's
I think
all very humiliating, actually. Humbling, humbling is the word.
you bring up something important. We tend to forget these things. And so, again, sometimes it's just good to remember that we did have the experience. And we can't duplicate these experiences. When something comes up, we can try to be more present for it. Now, most of the time, we tend to we're having a great experience, but we're not letting ourselves fully be there or fully absorb what it's like. Well, in the body, for one thing, it's like I've often used this as a teaching thing for how dukkha works, not only for bad things, but also diminishes our pleasure in good things. You're out there at sunset with the on a beach with a piña colada in your hand, and you're going, "I wish this could last forever," instead of just being there with the experience and remembering the experience. How often do we actually do that? That we actually diminish our enjoyment by comparing, by trying to hold on, by trying to duplicate the experience. Anyway, thank you for that, Rick. So, Isabel, you're muted, Isabel.
It was an awesome talk, haha.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And I wanted to just say one thing, and that is that I believe that our natural state is a blissful state, and everything that is placed on top of it in this lifetime is obscuring that. Short but sweet tonight. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Well, certainly when things get quiet in the mind, the state tends to be blissful. When all the voices and all the chatter settles down, it tends to be blissful. Now, I think that that chatter arose for some very important reasons in terms of how we have evolved. If Lucy and her friend Tilly were out on the savannah spending all their time being blissed out, they'd probably be eaten by lions. So, in a way, our problem-solving minds have served us well and have been important for us. But it's also been really helpful to us to learn how to settle the mind down, because we're not being hunted by lions right now, fortunately. So it's great to be able to find that stillness and that peace. And it's also really nice to know that when things are still in the mind, we're not in a state of misery. We're in a state of something that is described variously as bliss or calm or contentment or even an ecstatic state. So that's really good news. That not only do we have that capacity, it's something that underlies everything. It's something that's very basic to us. So, Rick, you wanted to say something else?
Yes, it occurred to me that I had a lot more near peak experiences that approach those, and that should be helpful to think of those to notice and think of those, like when Trump was defeated in 2020, that was a wonderful experience for me. Hopefully it'll be repeated again. soon. And or you know, when I climbed to the top of a hill and saw a beautiful sunset and stuff. Those kind of things happen more often in our lives.
Right. Well,
and should be savored and noted, and not try to not try to keep them, but I don't know. Just
next time you're watching a sunset, just as an exercise, how does the experience manifest? How does that pleasant experience manifest in the body? What does that happiness feel like? So anyway, thank you for bringing that up, Rick.
Yeah, another one that's quite common is when, you know, I have a lot of back trouble these days, but the good days, when it's gone, I notice those peak experiences. Pain-free days should be noticed, especially as you get older.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit like noticing the absence of the hindrances. You know, it's sort of a negative, you know, noticing when bad things are not there, but that is a very constructive thing to note.